So, it looks like the suspect is a large African-American man who is dressed all in yellow. I see. And his name is Lemon Fresh. Maybe. Possibly Yama. I don't know about that last part, but he's here, and he has a little girl with him. He's why everyone is riled up. On the bridge? No, not on the bridge. He's right under the bridge, in Fort Point. Fort Point, Lily repeated. I see. Shall I send someone to you? If you think they can help, said Mike. Well, they'll certainly try. Can you hold on a minute while I contact those people to help you? Sure, said Mike. Lily, I can't find Concepcion either. It's like she's lost in a storm. Let me see what I can do, Mike. Lily pushed the hold button, looked around the center. Mercifully, Sage wasn't working tonight, but a couple of the other counselors were glancing her way every few seconds. Leonidas was standing in the doorway of his office, his finger to the earpiece of a wireless headset. The fucker was listening in on her, live. Fine, he'd only hear her side and think her terminal was out of order. Pretending to scroll through contact numbers on her screen, she pulled her phone out of her purse and texted Charlie Asher. He's at Fort Point, under the bridge. She looked over her shoulder. Leonidas was frowning. He would have expected to hear her call to emergency services, even if he couldn't hear Mike's end of the conversation. She clicked off the hold button. Hi, Mike. I'm back. Sorry about that. Something seems to be wrong with my terminal. I texted the bridge authority, and they are on their way to you. I'll stay on the line with you until they reach you. I know you're covering, Lily. You need to know. I think I'm starting to get the point of all the stories the ghosts have been telling me. But I need to find Concepcion. She just evaporated right in front of me. I'm sure she'll be back any minute, Mike. I just had a similar experience, and I know how distressing that can be. But just stay calm, and the line clicked. The screen showed disconnected. She had the ability to call back each of the hard lines on the bridge, and she hit the button. Hello? A male voice, but different. She could hear wind, traffic, not the ghostly static that she heard when Mike called. Mike? No, this is Jeremy. Who's this? This is the crisis center for the bridge. Well, you guys should have blankets up here or something. It's really cold. I thought it was supposed to be warm in California. Well, you're standing over the mouth of a bay at night in the winter, you fucktard. Of course it's cold. She disconnected. When she looked back, Leonidas was heading for her desk. Her phone buzzed with a return message from Asher. He has Sophie. Fuck! The little girl Mike mentioned. She stood up, turned to Leonidas, did a traffic cop signal for him to stop right where he was. Get the fuck back in your office. This is my thing, and I need to be here. It's not my fault that this terminal isn't working right, but you didn't hear the other side of the conversation. If that guy calls back and I'm not here, someone is going to die. So get back in your office and chew my ass or fire me at the end of shift. But right now, I need to be here. Leonidas paused, seemed to be thinking, then said, end of shift. He turned and headed back to his office. Lily texted Charlie. Mike saw Sophie with Lemon at Fort Point. Chapter 27 Fort Point. Audrey dug her wallet out of her purse as she approached the nurse's desk. For the first time since she'd returned from Asia, she wished she was wearing her monk robes. She had three or four cards with her name and title ready, as well as her driver's license, which proved she was the person on the other cards. This was a first for her, but desperate times. Hello, I'm the Venerable Amitabha Audrey Walker Rinpoche, head of the Three Jewels Buddhist Center. Click, click, click went the cards on the desk. I am Mr. Fresh's spiritual guide. Our faith requires that I be present with the body at all times to help usher his spirit through bardo, from life to death. I need to be with Mr. Fresh. The nurse looked skeptically over her reading glasses. Luckily, she wasn't the nurse to whom Rivera had presented Audrey as a sketch artist, but she'd been at the desk for a while. She'd seen them all come and go, their strange displays of sorrow and joy. But she was used to dealing with people who were often at the most stressful point in their lives, and they didn't always react rationally when things got rough. He said the girl in the slutty schoolgirl outfit was his priest. Audrey knew she had some wiggle room here, because what most Americans knew about Buddhism came from a 40-year-old television show, the star of which had accidentally hanged himself while having a wank in a hotel wardrobe, so it was unlikely she'd be caught stretching the truth on doctrine. She is, but hers is a different discipline. To those who practice our faith, outward appearance is an illusion, a distraction from the true nature of our Dharma. Wait, let that sink in. No one knows what Dharma is. Wait, wait, this will work. He did have her down as his next of kin. All people of our faith are considered family. No, that sounded culty. She wanted to sound nice, not culty. And you need to be with the body how long? Until the soul has passed, usually less than a day. Could you step in here, please? The nurse went to the part of the desk that was behind the glass partition and waited for Audrey to pick up her IDs and come through the doors. Look, Miss Walker, we are going to have to send Mr. Fresh's body down to the morgue in a few minutes. Whether they let you stay with him will be up to them. You can stay with him until they come to get him, and I can vouch for you with the orderly who takes him down. But once you get there, you're going to have to tell them why you're there and see if they let you stay with him. What if I told them I was with the police? You saw we were with Inspector Rivera. The nurse's glasses slipped down again. You're a Buddhist priest and a policeman? Undercover. And technically, I'm a nun. I would watch that show, said the nurse. I wouldn't believe it, but I would watch it. Pardon? Go stay with Mr. Fresh, but stay with him. No wandering around doing detective work while you're tending to his soul. The nurse wondered why people never figured out that once you got your way, you could stop lying. It almost made her want to back up and revoke the permission she'd just given. Thank you, said Audrey. Blessings. 30 minutes later, Audrey was standing in a hallway by the gurney on which Minty Fresh's body lay when his eyes popped open. Hi, she said. She hit send on her phone, sending the message she'd typed in. He's alive. His eyes went wide and darted around, as if he were trying to remember how to speak. You were dead a little under an hour, she said. Think of it like a nap, really. Charlie told me you'd be back. Audrey watched as the confusion seemed to settle in Minty's eyes. This process was all new to her, too, but she had been present when the squirrel people came to life after they received a human soul. They were always disoriented and seemed to have to remind themselves of the confines of reality, because for them, reality had just been put in a jar and shaken vigorously. For some, it would settle. For others, it never seemed to. You're probably cold. They cut your pants off of you. And I don't know what happened to your shirt. I brought you these. She held up a pair of green scrubs she'd plucked from a bin as the orderly had rolled Minty Fresh's body through the basement hallway. I have your coat and your shoes, too. Shelf under the gurney. There's blood on one shoe. Sorry. Minty's eyes stopped darting. It seemed as if whatever part of him had been searching for reality had finally found it. They cut off my motherfucking custom-made leather pants? Look at you, all alive and stuff, she said. She thought she should have said something more profound, something from the Heart Sutra. Form does not differ from the void, and void does not differ from form. Perhaps. But instead, she said, who needs pants? You're alive. Spoken like someone who is alive and has pants. She threw him the scrubs. I'll turn my back and watch the hall. The big man sat up, turned sideways on the gurney, and began to worm his way into the scrubs. You presided at the death of a lot of people when you were a nun, right? I guided 153 souls through Bardo. So how was my death? Pretty good. A solid 7. Well above average. Did everyone cry? Well, most of the crying was done when they were still trying to save you. Lily was a mess. I wasn't in the room when you actually died, but it wasn't long before Charlie told us you were coming back, so everyone cheered up. I think Lily said yippee as she was leaving. Why isn't Charlie here? He told you, I'm guessing, where we went. Yes, but your cousin Lemon took Sophie. Shit. The ghost on the bridge told Lily that Lemon has Sophie at Fort Point under the bridge. Dressed, he said, The scrubs were extra large but not extra tall, so they fit him in the hips and shoulders. The pants, however, hit him just below the knee, and the shirt in the middle of his waist. He looked like a cross between a well-kept castaway and a very large Moroccan houseboy. "Anyone hurt?" "No, he just came to their apartment and took her. Jane and Cassie couldn't do anything to stop him."
"And the old Russian lady, she okay?"
"She'll recover," they're saying.
"And you? My cousin messed with you when he had you? Hurt you?"
"No, in fact, he stopped the Morrigan from hurting me."
"Why didn't he?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"I mean, why didn't he hurt you? Why didn't the old lady die? Why would he take Sophie? She's just a little girl now, right? If he's such a badass, how is it you're all alive?"
"Maybe he just wants a new order, like he said."
"Don't care what he wants," said Minty Fresh. "I want to know what he can do. How'd he get Nash's building through all that security?"
"They didn't say. Everything's always locked there."
"Then Lemon got a way of getting around that ain't a 49 Buick. You got a car?"
"In the parking garage."
"Lead on," said the mint one.
He hopped as he pulled on his black trainers, then grabbed his leather car coat from under the gurney.
"We're going to Fort Point."
Audrey sent a text to Charlie as they walked. "On our way to Fort Point."
"Fort Point," said Rivera. "Charlie, I don't know if I can get us in there. It's a national park. Since 9/11, it's been under Homeland Security. There are guards there with M4 rifles. Even the park rangers are armed. After what we pulled at the Fort Mason tunnel, there's no way the department is going to back me up if they call in to verify me."
They were in Rivera's Ford, just passing Fort Mason and the Marina Safeway on their way to Fort Point. Charlie said, "It's okay. They'll let me in."
"Why would they let you in?"
Charlie pulled Mike Sullivan's Bridge Authority ID and held it up. "Because I'm an employee. They need me to find another job in the park that gets me off the bridge. So even if they call in, someone will vouch. Everyone knows Mike Sullivan's story. I'll say I wanted to check it out when there were no tourists."
"They'll never let us in there without weapons," said Rivera.
"Anubis said weapons won't do us any good. They won't touch him."
"Well, I'm not sure what good we can do here, then."
"We have to be here. He has my daughter. She's just a little kid."
"Actually, she's probably not."
"What's that mean, she's probably not?"
"Why would this thing, this deity, go back and kidnap a little kid? What use is a random little kid to him? We would have taken a break if he hadn't taken her."
"I never thought about that. You think he still thinks she's the Luminatus?"
"He knows more about this stuff than I do, and he took her.
She is in the advanced reading group."
"Well, there you go," said Rivera.
Charlie's phone buzzed. Message from Audrey. "He's alive." Rivera pulled into the tourist parking area, which was still a good half mile from the fort. The remainder of the road had heavy vehicle barriers that rose out of the concrete to limit traffic to pedestrians and bicycles. However, currently, the barriers were down. Rivera killed the lights and drove to the parking lot adjacent to the fort. He stopped the car at the far edge of the parking lot and turned off the engine. There were a few vehicles near the fort, but they looked official. Light trucks and SUVs with national park insignias. Fort Point was a Civil War-era fortress, with 4-foot thick brick and concrete walls, and gun ports designed for a battery of cannons to defend the entire entrance to the San Francisco Bay. Even though the fort had lost its strategic value by the 1930s, the Golden Gate Bridge had been designed specifically so the fort would be preserved as an example of military architecture. The entrance from the city side of the bridge was a great structural steel arch that went directly over the top of the fort, rather than the more practical straight pylons that could have been built if the fort had been removed. As they climbed out of the car, Charlie's phone buzzed again. Audrey's message, "On our way to Fort Point." Charlie said, "They're on their way, maybe 20 minutes out."
"We should wait," said Rivera as he popped the trunk. "This Yama probably doesn't know we know he's here. We shouldn't blow our surprise when Fresh is the only one who has any way to fight him."
Rivera put his Beretta and holster in the trunk.
"I'm keeping the Glock on my ankle. If the guards notice it, I'll say I forgot I had it on."
"I have my sword cane," said Charlie. "As far as they know, I just fell off the bridge. They're not going to take away my walking stick."
"If it makes you feel better," said Rivera. The wind covered the sound of the car trunk closing, but also whipped their trouser cuffs around their legs. Strangely enough, Rivera's hair stayed perfect. "It's freezing out here," Charlie said. "We should wait in the car," Rivera said. They climbed back in the Ford. Charlie texted Audrey that they would wait for them in the parking lot. He hoped that she wasn't texting while driving, because that would be dangerous. No, she was smart. She'd hand her phone to the newly resurrected Egyptian demigod of death, rather than do anything careless. The light shining down from the bridge, plus a three-quarter moon, gave them light to see the entire southern side of the fort. No one was visible, not even at the main gate. "Where are the guards?" Rivera asked. "The park rangers." "You know I never actually worked on the bridge, right? Mike Sullivan did. I didn't even know there were guards here until you told me." "When Fresh gets here, you and Audrey need to stay here." "No. Charlie, where are the guards? You don't know that they haven't been shredded by the Morrigan and a lion in pieces inside." "No," said Charlie. "Fresh and I will get Sophie." "My daughter is in there, Inspector. Plus, do you think I've done battle with sewer harpies, been poisoned and died, been resurrected and lived as a meat puppet, then had someone throw himself off the Golden Gate Bridge to give me his body so I could sit in the fucking car?" Rivera considered it, ticked off Charlie's points in his head, considered his lack of concern for his own safety, then said, "Okay." "Okay," said Charlie. They sat in silence until Rivera spotted headlights in his mirror and watched them go out even as the car continued on. "Good girl, Audrey," he said. When Minty Fresh climbed out of the Honda, Charlie ran to him and threw his arms around the big man's waist. Minty held his arms out to his sides and looked from Audrey to Rivera with the humiliated but resolved look of a dog enduring a bath until Charlie finally let go and stepped back. "Sorry," Charlie said. "It's okay," said the mint one. Audrey bailed Charlie out by performing the same, yet somewhat more appropriate run and hug move on him. "So, how is dying?" Rivera asked Minty. Rivera raised an eyebrow at the mint one's outfit. "Not as relaxing as you think," said Minty. "Charlie says you have some yama-stopping mojo." "Yeah, about that. Anubis was less than clear what particular talent I would have, other than I would be his avatar in this world. Right now, I'm thinking pants would have been a good start." "Audrey," Rivera said, looking to the nun, "any hints?"
"I'm Buddhist. We believe all gods are illusions and constructions of ego. As far as I know, even you guys might be illusions."
"That's helpful," Rivera said.
"Namaste," Audrey replied. "If that's even your real name."
"What?"
"Sorry, Buddhist humor. Carry on."
Rivera glanced over his shoulder at the fort. "Okay, here's what we know. We can't see any guards or park rangers. But if they're there, and they should be, they'll be armed with M4 automatic rifles. There was nothing on the radio about gunfire here, so we have to assume that if Yama is in there, as the ghost says, then they either haven't seen him, or they haven't seen him as a threat, which means he doesn't have the Morrigan with them, because I can't really see them as coming off as non-threatening."
"Or all the guards are dead," said Audrey.
"Yes, there's that cheerful possibility," said Rivera. "So what do you think? Shotguns and stab-resistant vests?"
"Nah, this ain't gonna be no battle, Inspector."
Minty Fresh held up a finger as if testing the wind. "Anyone else hear that?" There was a whirring sound above the crash of the surf, the wind, and the traffic on the bridge, like the spooling up of an enormous jet engine. The others nodded, looked around.
"The fuck is that?" said Minty Fresh.
Audrey pointed up at the bridge, beyond the indirect floodlights that illuminated it and the red aircraft warning lights at the top of the towers. The bridge was beginning to glow, as if streaks of light were playing across its surfaces, someone painting it with moving lasers.
"Y'all seeing that?"
Charlie's phone buzzed. It was a message from Lily. "Mike says the ghosts of the bridge are coming up. Go now." He read the message to the others.
"That light must be visible for 20 miles, Audrey said. "Why isn't traffic screeching to a halt on the bridge?"
"Because they can't see or hear it," said Minty Fresh. "Same way they can't see the glow in a soul vessel, but we all can."
"I think we need to go now," said Rivera. He led them across the parking lot to the steel gates of the fort. There was a single heavy door in the middle of the gates. It was wide open. Rivera stopped at the edge, looked in, went back against the wall. He could see all the way into the center courtyard of the fortress. The side they were on had been the barracks, more or less just reinforced brick buildings with rooms for quartering and feeding soldiers. The other side of the fort was an arcade, three stories of heavy arches, in which the cannons had once nested, facing out to the bay. But now the spaces were empty of cannons and resembled rows of small theatrical stages. No one was visible from the door. No guards, no rangers, no man in yellow. The roar of the ghosts of the bridge was less like a jet now and more like an atmosphere, like the low rumble of a huge crowd, 10,000 voices in a small room. Rivera reached down and drew the Glock from his ankle holster.
I'm going in first. I'll signal when it's clear to follow.
Minty Fresh said,
You got some kind of death wish?
Apparently, said Rivera.
Oh, you can go first, said Minty, but put your gun away. You don't know there aren't guards in there. Might take someone sneaking in holding a Glock personally.
I'll go, said Charlie, as he breezed by them. Chapter 28 The Taunting of Minty.
Daddy!
Sophie called when Charlie entered the open courtyard of the fortress. She was standing four floors above him on a concrete gun platform. Lemon Fresh stood next to her. In the arched bay on the level below them, the Morrigans stained the bricks as tattered shadows. Only one of them still stood in three dimensions, cradling an arm with no hand attached. She hissed, and Charlie jumped back a little.
How you doing? Said Lemon.
Are you okay, honey? Charlie said.
I'm okay, said Sophie. But it's cold, and I haven't had a snack in days.
She glared at Lemon. Her dark pigtails whipped around her face in the wind. Don't be scared, honey. Daddy is here.
I'm not scared, Daddy. I just need some crunchy cheese newts up in this bitch.
Lemon looked over at Sophie, who, because she stood on the gun mount, was eye level with him.
Where you learn to talk like that, child?
Lemon looked down at Charlie.
What you teaching this child?
She's gifted, Charlie said.
More important,
Lemon said, moving his right hand in a stirring motion.
Why ain't you sleeping?
Charlie looked around. Along the edges of the courtyard, the arcade on Lemon's side and the colonnade on his side, slept a half dozen rangers. Not dead or injured. They looked as if they'd simply gotten tired and decided to take a nap. One woman was curled up around her M4 rifle, as if it were a body pillow. Amid the whir of the ghosts of the bridge above, Charlie could hear one fellow who was sitting against a column on his side of the courtyard, snoring softly, his face under the cover of his Smokey the Bear hat.
I guess I'm gifted, too, said Charlie.
He gestured for the others to join him. Minty Fresh stepped out of the shadows, right behind him. Audrey was a few columns down, checking on a sleeping ranger. Rivera looked out from behind a column.
New meat, snarled Nemain. This time you'll stay dead. I'll suck the soul from you while you're still bleeding.
The fuck, Lemon, said Minty Fresh. Control your bitches.
Lemon shrugged. What you gonna do?
Y'all act like I brought the ladies to the party. But they come on their own, cuz. A door open up out the underworld. There they is. It's y'all's fault they're here. All y'all let shit get so fucked up here, they was drawn here like hoes to coke.
He took my hand, said Nemain.
And you said you killed him, said Lemon. Yet there he is, alive as a motherfucker, wearing some poor child's PJs.
With that, Lemon started to laugh, then bent over and wheezed a little bit, raising a palm to hold his place in the taunting.
What you wearing, Minty?
I'm comfortable, said Minty. Why don't you send that child down here to her daddy, Lemon? You and me talk this out.
Nah, she's mine now, said Lemon.
He reached out to stroke Sophie's cheek, and his irises lit up like fire. Inspector Alphonse Rivera had been a policeman more than 25 years, and in all that time, from working a patrol car to narcotics to homicide, he had never shot a person. He had drawn his weapon, of course, but he had never had to fire on a human being.
He'd always been very good at assessing a situation and acting quickly and appropriately when he needed to, as if his mind could prepare dozens of if-then triggers that would put him in motion without hesitating. When Lemon Fresh touched Sophie's cheek, one of those triggers fired. In a single motion, Rivera went to one knee, drew the Glock from his ankle holster, aimed, and fired four shots in quick succession. Everyone, including the Morrigan, jumped at the sound of gunfire. Four copper-jacketed bullets hung in the air, stopped about 2 inches from Lemon's face. All could have fit in the space of a tennis ball. Rivera had never shot a person, but Nick Cavuto had been a bit of a handgun enthusiast, so the partners had spent a lot of hours together practicing at the range.
"Hoo-wee," said Lemon Fresh.
He looked all around the bullets, getting a view from different angles.
"This motherfucker can shoot."
Nemain screeched and leapt out of the arch, where she had been standing across the open courtyard toward Rivera, the claws of her only remaining hand extended. Rivera fired four times again, adjusting aim with each shot, catching her in the collarbone once and in the face three times, spattering bits of black, feathery goo into the air. She landed face first on the concrete floor and slid several feet until she was only inches from Rivera, who held aim on her. As they watched, she melted to an inky shadow and flowed backward, up the arches, until she joined her sisters as another tattered silhouette against the red bricks.
"Well, that didn't work," said Nemain. "Told you," said Babbed. "When we get the souls, he's the first to go," said Macha.
Rivera ejected the spent clip and snapped a full one from his jacket into the gun.
"Sure can't shoot," said Lemon.
He made a fist and the bullets hanging before him dropped out of the air with a thud and clatter.
"Your standard issue Negro wouldn't stand a chance, but I am what..."
He deferred with a bow to Sophie.
"A dookie face," she said.
"That's right," said Lemon, winking at her. "A magical Negro."
He looked to Rivera.
"And because I am only interested in nonviolence and harmony among all creatures, I am going to put you to sleep rather than crush you like a motherfucking bug."
Lemon waved his palm at Rivera like a hypnotist putting a subject to sleep. Rivera adjusted his aim for the movement, but otherwise did not move. Lemon repeated the sleep gesture. Nothing. He searched the courtyard until he found Audrey, who was checking the pulse of another downed ranger, and tried the sleep gesture on her.
"Yeah, nothing," said Audrey.
"What did y'all stop at Starbucks on the way here?" "Well, I tried. Ladies, I think you're gonna need to go get you some breakfast. Go get 'em."
With that, the Morrigan slithered out of their archway, up the wall, over the roof of the fortress, and away. Sophie ran to the edge of the wall to follow their progress, then came back to Lemon's side.
"They're silly!"
"You don't never be lying, Peanut," said Lemon.
Charlie was caught between being horrified and relieved that his darling little girl was discussing the silliness of a trio of Celtic death goddesses with a vengeful Buddhist deity dressed like a citrus fruit.
"Lemon, enough of this nonsense," said Minty Fresh. "You need to send that little girl down here now. Me and you will work this out."
"Can't do that, cuz. I need her for what I'ma do. You do know she's the big D, right?"
Minty Fresh looked around at his companions. If Lemon didn't know Sophie had lost her powers, he didn't think it good strategy to tell him now.
"There they go."
Lemon turned and looked at the bridge. Three dark streaks were making their way up the concrete pylons toward the steel cables and arches, which were glowing with the neon flow of mad ghosts.
"They just need to move one more obstacle out of my way, and we'll all be done here. All them poor souls will be released, and whatever bullshit y'all have been perpetrating here will be over. Everything will be copacetic. In order. Bitches just need to shred them a ghost thief. I expect by the time they find him, they'll be plenty strong enough. Gonna cost some souls, bless their hearts."
Charlie felt his phone buzz in his pocket and checked it. Lily.
"Hold that thought," he said. "I have to take this."
Lily said,
Asher, I'm on the hard line with Mike Sullivan. He says the ghosts on the bridge are out of control, and there's some dark force moving on them.
That's the Morrigan.
Well, stop them!
They're kind of out of range.
Charlie looked back over his shoulder. The dark streaks of shadows that were the Morrigan were almost to the steel arch above them. The ghosts, or the ghost light, seemed to be moving toward them, as if to meet them, swarming along the arch above the fort.
Lemon says they're going to shred the ghost thief. Tell Mike.
Charlie could hear Lily in the background talking on her headset.
I told him, she said.
What did he say?
He said that was weird.
They all watched as the dark streaks that were the Morrigan took shape as a cloud of black birds, then morphed into their human woman forms. The Morrigan stood on the girders of the arch above them, but the dark tide of ghosts continued to swell toward them until the Morrigan's dark edges began to glow, then pulsate, brighter and brighter. Finally, the three of them popped like soap bubbles. Black confetti or tiny feathers burst into three distinct bursts, like negative fireworks made of darkness. An elliptical lens opened in the sky beneath the bridge, a trick of light. The Morrigan confetti fell into it, and the lens closed.
Mike says it's okay now, Lily said. She disconnected.
When Charlie turned back around, Lemon Fresh was bent over laughing again.
That shit is funny. You see that? They went sucked up and bust like balloons. Like we used to feel when your mama made hush puppies, Minty. That woman could fry her some hush puppies, rest her soul.
Don't act like you planned that, Lemon, said Minty Fresh.
I did plan that, cuz. Them bitches was crazy. I told you, I'm here to see all them poor, lost souls released from that bridge. All them souls y'all got in jars and golf clubs and I don't know what. That ain't right. That ain't the right way of things.
Audrey moved to Minty Fresh's side.
He did save me from them, and he didn't hurt any of these guards. He hasn't harmed Sophie. He may just be making way for a new order, a new path. There's always chaos when systems are realigning. Yama is a god of death, but he was made protector of Buddhism, protector of the way.
That's right, Minty. I'm protector of the way. I don't judge, like you all do. The Morrigan was a different thing. They all about war. Me, I'm all about love.
Uh-huh,
said Minty, unconvinced. I'm going to get my daughter, Charlie said. He started up one of the four flights of stairs on their side of the fortresses.
She fine right here, said Lemon. Once I'm done with my business, y'all can take her home.
All right, said Minty Fresh. I'll wait up there then.
He started for the staircases on the side of the courtyard opposite where Charlie had gone up. Once they got to the top, they'd be closing on Lemon from either side. Rivera joined Audrey in the edge of the courtyard, the Glock hanging at his side.
You believe what you just said?
She shook out her hair.
I did when I said it.
Minty came around the roof of the fortress on the left, Charlie on the right.
Y'all can stop right there, said Lemon. I need Peanut here for my business.
Sophie jumped down from the gun platform and ran toward Charlie.
Daddy!
Lemon dropped his hand and Sophie stopped in her tracks. Charlie drew the sword from his cane.
Let her go!
Lemon raised his hand toward Charlie, who stopped and struggled, as if his feet were stuck to the cement. Minty Fresh was only 20 feet away from Lemon when the yellow fellow turned and stopped him with the same gesture.
Not now, cuz. Let me get to this.
Lemon, I'm gonna bust your ass I get hold of you, said Minty.
Under his breath, he said,
Anubis, you gonna give me some mojo? Now would be a good time.
Lemon moved until he was standing directly over Sophie. She screamed. He turned toward the bridge with his arms raised high in invitation.
Come on, y'all. Come on here.
The ghosts of the bridge swirled and stormed, the light moving out now, away from the structure, the streams of ghosts arching toward Lemon.
Come on, my babies. Daddy gonna take you home.
I burned up your Buick,
said Rivera from below in the courtyard. Lemon tried not to, but looked over his shoulder at the cop.
What you say?
This morning, after everyone else left the tunnel at Fort Mason,
I went back and threw a highway flare in the back seat of your Buick.
You did not, said Lemon.
Let him go, Audrey said. He's trying to freeze those souls.
I got out of there before it blew up, but it did blow up. Like a blast furnace in there, said Rivera. I'm in a bit of trouble over it, but on the bright side, your Buick is nothing but frame and warm lug nuts now.
You a dead 5-0, Lemon said.
He turned toward Rivera and lost whatever concentration he had on the bridge. The ghosts resumed their frenzied trip back up the metal frame and cables. Lemon raised an arm as if winding up a baseball pitch, and before he could come down, a dark figure appeared behind him.
Aye! Shrieked the Banshee, and she touched the stun gun to Lemon's neck. Bzzzt.
As Lemon turned to face his attacker, the Banshee ducked under his arm, grabbed Sophie's hand, and pulled her away from him.
Hello, love, said the Banshee, pulling the child into her skirts. You smell like barbecue, Sophie said.
Lemon rubbed the back of his neck as if he'd smacked a particularly annoying mosquito, the stun gun no more than a minor annoyance.
You'll not do that again, he said, his voice sounding different now. Not the smooth and amused Lemon.
The Buick was in the tunnel? Minty Fresh asked Rivera. How did the Buick get in that tunnel?
Same way the Morrigan got out, I guess, said Rivera.
Oh, for fuck's sake, you great dog-headed ninny, what are you waiting for? Said the Banshee.
Lemon turned to her and froze her as she backed away with Sophie.
You too, Banshee, when I'm finished, said Lemon, still in a voice that was very unlemony.
He raised his arms and began drawing down the ghosts of the bridge again, their light arching toward him. Above, on the steel arch of the bridge, stood a lone figure wearing painter's coveralls.
Let him do it, Audrey said. Yama is the guardian. He's bringing on the new order.
He's not Yama, you twit, said the Banshee. He's bloody Set, Lord of Darkness and Betrayal and General Fuckery, isn't he? He's not releasing these souls to become part of the bloody universe. He's trying to absorb them. They'll become part of his great twatty ego, and good luck then.
Oops, said Audrey. Lemon spun on the Banshee and made to strike her. But his hand passed right through her.
Aye!
She shrieked at him.
The Buick was in the tunnel, Minty said.
Oh, I see. Yes, love, said the Banshee. Set has been opening portals into the underworld to get around, as any proper demigod would. Do you need a diagram?
I knew we needed a diagram, Charlie said. Thumbtacks and string, right? Minty Fresh's golden eyes began to glow like Lemon's now, and he smiled. The portal opened in the tunnel under Fort Mason Green, and the hellhounds emerged. They were creatures of fire and force, with the scent of their prey in their noses, and they entered the world above at a full run, their paws throwing up bits of burned Buick as they crashed through the wooden barrier at the end of the tunnel in a shower of splinters, and they made for Fort Point. There were few people out at that hour, and those who saw them thought them a trick of the light, shadows thrown by a spotlight from Alcatraz, perhaps, because nothing real could be moving that fast that far away from the road. They stayed close to the shore, leaping fences or parked cars when necessary, tearing through hedges like cannonballs through lace curtains, past the Marina Green, where children flew kites and played soccer during the day, past Crissy Field, where thousands gathered to watch fireworks or boat races, past the St. Francis Yacht Club, the old fort warehouses, now businesses, down the old Battery Trail, their paws kicking back gravel with enough force to chip a windshield. A snowflake flurry pattern spattered in the windscreen of Rivera's Ford as they raced through the Fort Point parking lot. They were creatures of spirit and elation, and they hadn't seen him in well over a year, yet they knew his scent, his essence, even though he wore a new body. They came through the fort gates frisking like lambs, slobbering and whining in great doggy joy, bounded up the stairs and fell upon Charlie, soaking him with hellish dog spit.
Goggies!
Called Sophie, with a little girl yodel of a laugh. Frozen in place by Lemon's magic, Charlie endured the great hound's affection as best he could, bending here and there as they rubbed their faces on him, licked him, and finally made him the center of an enormous welcome home double dog hump, a mighty black pyramid of doggy delight, red rocket dog dinguses thrusting at him like slippery spears.
"The goggies love to dance with Daddy,"
Sophie said, offhand to Lemon, whose eyes had gone wide at the sight of the great hounds.
"They missed him!"
"Help,"
Charlie called.
"I'm being humped to death."
"I love," said the banshee, "but it's a dry hump."
"Not him," said Minty Fresh,
his voice now filled with the booming resonance of Anubis.
"No, goggies,"
called Sophie.
"Down! Down!"
The hounds looked over to Sophie, dropped Charlie like a drooly tennis ball, then bounded over to her. Lemon forgot completely what he was doing, forgot he was drawing down the power of thousands of souls, forgot that when he finished, he would rule over the realms of light and darkness, and turned to run. The stream of ghosts that he had been pulling down to him snapped back to the bridge. Lemon threw his hands apart, as if pushing soap suds off the surface of a wash basin, and a portal opened in the fortress courtyard, shimmering like a black mirror. He took a step back to gather speed to leap the four floors when Alvin's jaws clamped down on his arm, jerking him back like a rag doll. His yellow Homburg hat fluttered from his head and disappeared into the underworld. Alvin shook him twice before Muhammad caught his other arm.
"Hold!"
said Minty Fresh, who was Anubis. The hellhound stopped, held Lemon, and growled like idling Ferraris. Minty stepped from where he'd been frozen in place and stood before Lemon, who was Set, once Egyptian lord of the underworld.
"Hey, Lemon, how you like the goggies?"
Minty spoke in his own voice now.
"I ain't gonna lie, cuz," said Lemon. "I do not care for them."
"You done here. You know that, right?"
Lemon hung limp between the two hounds, defeated for a second. Then he grinned.
"That was gonna be some big-ass consciousness, though, once I become the Luminatus. Some motherfucking world-burning will."
"Yeah, that ain't never gonna happen. Here's what's going to happen. These goggies are gonna take you to a pit where Ahmet has been waiting for your tender ass for thousands of years. Now, I know he can't end you, but he gonna chew you up and shit you out in little pieces. And if you ever get your shit together, because that happens with our peoples, these two hellhounds will be waiting on you, Lemon. You can slow them up, but you can't stop them. They will follow you to the ends of the world and the ends of the underworld. They will never give up, and they will never die. You can't control them, and you can't kill them. And there ain't but one person can ever call them off. And she's standing right there."
Minty pointed.
"Sup,"
said Sophie.
"There is no kryptonite for these motherfuckers, Lemon. Do you feel me?"
"You a hard man, Minty Fresh," said Lemon.
"Go,"
said Minty. The hellhounds leapt off the arcade with Lemon between them and fell the four stories into the portal to the underworld, which closed behind them with the sound of a light bulb popping.
"Bye, goggies," said Sophie.
Minty Fresh looked up to the lone figure standing on the bridge above them, amid the maelstrom of ghosts, and waved. Mike Sullivan waved back and disappeared into the flow. Chapter 29. So That Happened.
Crisis Center, this is Lily. What's your name?
Lily, this is Mike.
Mike, what's going on? Asher said it's over. What's over?
I found out, Lily. I found out why I listened to all those stories. What I'm doing here. I'm supposed to lead them. I'm the ghost thief.
That's great, Mike. I have no idea what that means.
I'm supposed to lead them all off the bridge. Show them where they're supposed to go. All the souls stuck here with unresolved lives. They just need to live another life. Learn the lesson. That's what the ghost thief was supposed to do. Steal the ghosts from the bridge.
Why you?
Evidently, I'm an ascended soul. Or I will be.
Which is?
It means I'm finished having lives. I move on now.
What about Concepcion? Did you find her?
She's here, with me now.
Well, she might have told you.
She didn't know. She just knew we had to find the ghost thief.
We didn't know who it was, what it was.
I had to hear the stories of the ghosts of the bridge, become aware of what they were and what we were, what we are.
She's an ascended soul, too.
How is that possible?
She's been stuck on the bridge.
Well, in the Golden Gate for what?
200 years?
She was waiting for me. I guess I had lives to live to catch up to her.
Well, really, a smart girl would have been wasted on you.
I wanted you to know, Lily. I'm moving on, and after hundreds of years waiting, Concepcion is moving on, too. We're going together.
To where?
Because I've been to Marin, and it's not that great.
Can you envision two beings, people, meant for each other? The elation of being in love? Completely aware of your connection to that person? Like you are part of them, and they are part of you? Inseparable?
That's a thing? That's what you have with Concepcion?
Yes, but an ascended soul feels that way toward everything.
Is that way with everything.
That's where we're going.
Sort of everywhere.
Well, you'll want to take a jacket.
I wanted to say thanks, Lily.
You're welcome.
And goodbye.
Bye, Mike.
I'll be here if shit gets weird.
We wouldn't want that, said Mike.
Then he showed them the way. Those souls that had been lost at the Golden Gate for years, decades, centuries, mad as bedbugs, they came to themselves, and those who had lessons to learn returned to new bodies, new lives, to take a turn on the wheel of life and death once again. And those like Mike and Concepcion, who were the compilation of dozens of lives, who had found the way, become aware, ascended together in loving kindness, to hold each other and all things, one with the universe, complete.
Rivera was leading the Emperor and his men out of the kennel at the Department of Animal Control when she appeared.
"Ayee!" cried the Banshee.
Rivera didn't even jump, although Bummer and Lazarus saw to it that the sooty wraith got a good barking at before the Emperor distracted them with a beef jerky Rivera had brought for just such an emergency.
"So this is going to continue?" Rivera said.
He was very tired and still had to get two dogs and a lunatic across town to the utility closet where they lived before he rested.
"No, love. The doom is done. I'm just popping by to ask if I can keep this."
She held up the stun gun and gave it a buzz.
"The wee box of lightning adds spice to the task."
"Sure, keep it," said Rivera. "What now?"
"I thought I'd go shriek at someone. I quite enjoy that."
"Yes, you do. Be careful with that thing."
"Not a worry. I'll only use it on those who aren't properly surprised by the shrieking. By the by, love, when you get back to your store, I think you'll want to have a look in your death book. Surprises, don't you know?"
"Thanks. I will."
"Ta,"
she said, and in a wisp of smoke, she was gone.
"That's somewhat disturbing," said the Emperor.
The men frisked at his sides, hopeful eyes searching for another beef jerky.
"She does that," said Rivera.
He led them to the brown Ford and opened the rear door for them.
"Did you get your journal?" he asked.
"In the recycle bin," said the Emperor. "Its purpose has been served. I'm going to turn my attentions to the living citizens of my city. They need me."
"Of course they do," said Rivera.
The Emperor and his men tumbled into the Ford, and Rivera drove them to North Beach, where he installed them in their closet with a large sausage pizza, several bottles of water, and two new wool blankets before he went home and fell into a sleep as deep as the dead. Religion in Chinatown, as in most places, is based less on a cogent theology and more on a collection of random fears, superstitions, prejudices, forgotten customs, vestigial animism, and social control. Mrs. Ling, while a professed Buddhist of the Pure Land tradition, also kept waving cat charms, lucky coins, and put great faith in the good fortune of the color red.
She gave gifts of money on the Chinese New Year, threw I Ching coins for guidance, believed in the comfort of ghost brides for old men who died alone, and was very much in favor of any tradition, superstition, or ritual that involved fireworks, including New Year's, Independence Day, and the end of the giant season. She followed the Chinese zodiac with a stubborn devotion, and because she was born in the year of the dragon, she thought them the luckiest of all creatures. Which was why her friend, Vladlena Korjev, found her in the state she did when she returned home from the hospital. Having not encountered her friend in the hallways after 2 days home, and hearing strange noises at Mrs. Ling's door, Mrs. Korjev did as they had agreed, in case we fall and break hip like bear, and used her key to let herself in to Mrs. Ling's apartment. She found her friend seated at one end of the sofa, watching her stories on the Chinese channel, while at the other end of the sofa sat Wiggly Charlie. Each was joyfully eating a mozzarella stick. And Mrs. Ling, who was mildly lactose intolerant, let fly with a diminutive of gas every 30 seconds or so, at which both she and Wiggly Charlie would snicker until they wheezed.
"He lucky dragon," explained Mrs. Ling.
Wiggly Charlie had avoided the brazed fate of a prior and less chatty squirrel person when, after being roughly yanked from his cat carrier by his feet, he asked a petite matron for a cheese, thereby establishing his lucky magic dragonness. Mrs. Ling agreed that if Mrs. Korjev would keep the secret, she could share in the dragon's luck, and the three spent many a pleasant afternoon sitting on the sofa, dragon in the middle, grandmother on either end, watching stories, eating cheese sticks, and gleefully giggling at Mrs. Ling's delicate condition. Some mornings, Mrs. Ling would put Wiggly Charlie in the cat carrier and take him for a ride around the neighborhood in her cart, feeling very special and blessed among the multitudes of North Beach and Chinatown, for she alone rolled with a dragon. Other mornings, Wiggly Charlie spent with Mrs. Korjev, who would stand him on her counter and drill him like a Cossack sergeant major.
"Need a cheese," Wiggly Charlie would say.
"How you need cheese?" Mrs. Korjev would inquire.
"Like bear,"
the lucky dragon would reply, and thus a cheese would be bestowed upon the Long Dong dragon. The care and feeding of their lucky dragon, as well as the leap in credibility engendered by his very existence, helped the two grandmothers better adjust to the condition of their Sophie, who now had not two, but three mommies, and to the fact that the sneaky, usurping drug fiend Mike Sullivan was, in fact, Charlie Asher. Once you accept you have a miniature talking dragon in your midst, the idea that your former landlord has changed bodies and has taken a Buddhist nun as a bride is a minor leap of faith. Audrey left her resident position at the Buddhist Center and moved in with Charlie, despite some objections from Sophie.
"Really, Dad? The shik's a booty nun?"
And they, with the help of two loving aunties and the two rental grandmothers, set about raising the little girl, who would possibly grow up to be Death.
"Maybe she has always had the powers, but just didn't want to hurt anyone," said Audrey.
"So you think my daughter may still be Death, but she's broken?" Charlie said.
"Not broken," Audrey said. "Just not finished yet."
"I'm telling you, that child is not normal," said Minty Fresh, who had seen her through the eyes of Anubis and knew. "For one thing, she got a mouth on her like a sailor."
"Her Auntie Jane is very proud of that," said Charlie. After a time, their suspicions about Sophie's future were confirmed when the hellhounds returned and remained Sophie's constant companions, everywhere but at school, where they waited patiently outside as she instructed until they could escort her home in the afternoon. The Goggies were quite happy and fairly well-behaved, only occasionally sneaking down to a North Beach sidewalk cafe where one would eat a comfort dog off the lap of some self-indulgent diner, only to return looking innocent, but for the leash hanging out of the corner of his mouth. To atone, Charlie encouraged San Francisco's animal control people to put the hellhounds down, and at Sophie's instruction, they would go away in the back of a truck, only to return a few hours later, justice done, somewhat stoned on whatever poison they'd been given, to resume spinning bags of kibble into great steaming spools of stool.
When Inspector Alphonse Rivera returned to his bookstore and opened his copy of the Great Big Book of Death, he found the entire text had been changed to the following. Congratulations. You were one of the select few chosen to act as Death. It was a dirty job, but someone had to do it. A new order has been established, and your services will no longer be required. Feel free to keep the calendar and the number two pencils for your own personal use. Best of luck in all your future endeavors. Rivera called the other death merchants that he knew to confirm that their copies of the Big Book had changed as well, which they had. For a moment, he considered putting a price tag on his copy of the Big Book and offering it for sale in his shop. But after contemplating how sneaky and ever-changing the universe appeared to be, he decided instead to keep it in his personal collection, just for reference, in case things got weird. He also decided, having served 25 years as a policeman and survived the reset of the wheel of life and death, still never having shot a human being, nor having been shot, that he would take a second retirement and become a bookseller full-time, despite the precarious prospects of that profession. On his second day of his second retirement, Rivera called Lily Severo's mother, Elizabeth, and invited her to join him for coffee. The two found they quite liked each other and started dating regularly. What began as gratitude for being rescued from loneliness developed into love. They reveled in sharing who they were and how they had come to this place in their lives, and everything was made that much sweeter by how much their relationship annoyed Lily. Lily, having served nobly as oracle to the bridge, found the specialness she felt by having been chosen remained, even after the ghosts moved on. She comported herself, at least outwardly, with less cynicism and hostility toward the world. And at times, with humility and style, if only because she knew secretly how much it annoyed everyone who had known her before. "So," Charlie Asher said to her, "I'm going to reopen the shop. I mean, it was a successful business for my family for 30 years before I became Death. There's no reason why it can't be again, and the pizza oven is still in there. So I thought we might go into business together." "So it would be Asher's Random Used Crap and Artisanal Pizza?" "No, not necessarily. You could put your name on the sign, too." "Thanks, Charlie, but I don't think so. I'm going to stay at the Crisis Center and go back to school. Get a degree in counseling, maybe even become a psychologist." "That's horrifying," Charlie said. "I mean, I'm happy for you, I'm proud of you, but your poor patients." "Hey, blow me, Asher. Those crazy fucks will be lucky to have me." "That's what I meant," he said. "I have a knack with the damaged," Lily said. "It's my thing. Speaking of which, I'm supposed to go see M." The Mint One, his duty as a demigod done for now, returned to fresh music and resumed his business to great success. Despite the lack of any supernatural stimulus, the current horde of elitist music enthusiasts with money that were infesting the city, each looking for anything more obscure and or arcane than his contemporaries, had created a booming market for worthless crap that Minty Fresh had long ago relegated to the realm of unsellable. And the buyback market, fueled by their mercurial smartphone-crippled attention spans, was whipped into a light and frothy profit. He was adding up the day's receipts, and Bitch's Brew was playing in the background when Lily came into the shop. "Look," she said, "you are not the love of my life, but you are definitely a love in my life, so if you're okay with that, I'd love to spend some more time with you. But if I break your heart, I warned you, so it's fair."
"I'd like that," said Minty Fresh, "but you're not going to break my heart. I am the human presence of an ancient Egyptian god of death, girl."
"Sure, throw that in my face. But I got my thing, too. And besides, you cried on my voicemail." She made as if to draw her phone out and play the proof. "You want me to break your heart. That's not healthy."
"I do not want that. I am not the blues. I am jazz. I want to be present, in the moment, not wallow in it. Do you feel me?"
"About that. How is it you're all erudite and nerdy some of the time, and other times you're all smooth and badass and black?"
"I'm black as I need to be. I use a language that serves what I have to say. You cool with that?"
"Are you cool with me thinking that Miles Davis sounds like he's smothering squirrels?"
Minty Fresh feigned taking an arrow to the heart, then shook it off.
I guess Miles don't work for everybody.
And Pizzazz was a stupid name for a restaurant.
Well, I don't
admit it.
All right. Pizzazz was a stupid name for a restaurant.
Good, I win, she said, moving close enough to the counter so he could kiss her when the time came. Now we can play for fun. When the ghosts of the bridge rose to find their places in the universe, so too did all the souls in all the soul vessels around the world, the souls of the surviving squirrel people who had turned to neo-druids since the attack of the Morrigan and who had built a miniature Stonehenge from stolen hotel mini-fridges in their amphitheater beneath the Buddhist Center, also found their way back onto the wheel of life and death, most moving on to live new lives as humans, except for Bob, who was Thebe, whose soul would be reincarnated twice as a woodchuck and once as a hedgehog to present to him the lesson of humility, because the universe thought he had been kind of a dick. When the ghosts of the bridge rose to find their places in the universe, Jean-Pierre Baptiste just happened to be cradling the cat person who had been his patient and friend, Helen. She went limp in his arms, and he could see the red glow of her soul in her chest ascend and pass through the ceiling. Baptiste knew he would have some difficulty breaking the habit of being kind to Helen, and would have to console himself by being actively kind to other patients, as did most of the people of his calling. Not coincidentally, halfway around the world, in Paris, on the 400-year-old stone bridge over the Seine, called the Pont Neuf, a craftsman named Jacques was repairing one of the carved marble faces that decorated the fascia of the bridge when a ghost appeared, sitting on the railing above him. She wore the mid-calf tweed skirt and crisp white blouse of a college girl from the mid-20th century on her semester abroad in Paris. She wore her hair shoulder-length and curled under in the style of Katharine Hepburn's in Bringing Up Baby, Kate being her idol.
"Bonjour, monsieur," she said to Jacques. "Je suis Helen."
And she proceeded to outline, in French, with a heavy American accent, what would be required of him. And different ghosts, each more charming than the last, appeared to people on bridges all over the world, and thus was established the new turn of the wheel of life and death, so that each soul on its journey between bodies would pause in a place between places, and then continue on toward its proper place as part of the universe. This is Fisher Stevens. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Secondhand Souls by Christopher Moore. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer and director, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2015 by Christopher Moore. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.